Welcome to the 88th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome. Well, I guess today we'll start out a little bit with what I'm up to because it's getting a little bit busy again. In the gardening front, it is very hot in Florida. We've been doing the majority of our gardening Sunday afternoon after our long bike ride. So I'm kind of calling it cross training because we certainly sweat like it's another endurance activity with lugging dirt and preparing beds and things. So I think 4 or 5 hours of gardening in the Florida afternoon sun hopefully counts for something, especially as I work up to my Ironman here in the near future. What I have noticed about the gardening, which is, you know, relatively new for me as an adult, is that it's kind of meditative. You know, 3 or 4 hours will go by and really haven't thought about anything except what I'm doing. And so I find that very interesting, especially when you look at the blue zones, and especially people in Okinawa that have their backyard gardens and, you know, their increased well-being. So, you know, I kind of highly recommend it as a, even though we're working hard and sweating, it's extremely relaxing at the same time. Clears your head. I never think about work. I never think about my other endurance activities. I don't think about any problems or any, you know, that any of the world's problems that I might try to solve when I'm doing other things. So it's very, very interesting. Welcome, Vinny. It's that time of year when we're starting to plan out our raised bed. So right now, last weekend, I actually harvested sweet potatoes out of one raised bin, and we've probably got a couple dozen sweet potatoes, so that's pretty exciting for Florida to take all those vines down and actually find potatoes. I'm still harvesting okra every day, so I'm finding numerous different ways to try to make okra dishes, so it's been a lot of fun. Still, my favorite is roasted in the oven, I think. It's pretty good in the gumbo, too. So our plan is to have the okra bed become the corn and bean bed, and then we'll have another bed with tomatoes, peppers, and carrots. The sweet potato bed will still be the sweet potato bed. We're going to have another raised bed with cabbage, Brussels, radishes, and then add some greens and kale and Swiss chard where we can. I have herbs on the porch, cilantro, ulantro, which is a cilantro on steroids that was given to me, a couple kinds of basil, oregano, thyme, a couple kinds of mint, sage. Those are all on raised beds on the porch. We've planted some new peppers, hot and bell peppers, and a couple different kinds of tomatoes. So looking forward to getting those things in. My papaya tree is really starting to blossom. There's 6 papayas hanging on it now, so that's really exciting to look forward to having my own fruit. We have 2 pomegranate trees that are really starting to take off. The banana trees are taking off, and so hopefully next year we'll see some fruit as well. My Ironman is October the 8th. It's in Louisville, so it's pretty much down to 1 month. So it's getting to peak training time. I can feel it because I'm getting kind of tired in the morning. I wake up, and I'm not real excited about getting out there. But once I get going, I'm okay. Thankfully, nothing is hurting, so that's real good. I don't have any nagging injuries, knock on wood, at this stage. The long runs are starting to peak. It's kind of hot here in Florida this time of the year, so hydration's an issue. Hopefully it won't be in Louisville in October, but usually I hydrate with water and for the first 7 miles, and then I switch to electrolyte replacement called Scratch for the next 7 miles, and then finish up with water and gels for the rest of that run, and that seems to be working out. I usually start with a couple dates and a cup of coffee before I start out. Kind of is my last bit of procrastination before I head out the door for the long run. I've run a lot of marathons, and the 20-mile runs, you know, they get pretty long in training. But it's, you know, it's a really good thing as far as you know, learning to pace yourself and not think too far ahead and stay in the moment. You know, that first, if you think on the first mile that you've got, 19 more, it can be a little bit daunting. But I break it up with the dogs. So 3.5 with each dog. And then I go out for my own loops by myself when it starts to get hotter. And I usually take a podcast with me or an audiobook. Right now I'm reading a book on the microbiome that I'll talk a little bit. I guess I'm listening to a book on the microbiome that I'll talk about a little bit later. So that helps break it up because I kind of look forward to listening to those things, guys. So I kind of zone out. For Ironman marathon, it's kind of a survival fest. So I'm not looking to do any fast pace runs for the most part. Usually with the second, Gretchen is the second dog out, and she runs a little bit faster pace. So I usually run a little faster pace with her for 3 or 4 miles. And then I try to pick it up at the end and bring it home, faster than the middle mile. So, but that's about the only thing I do as far as, any kind of speed effort during my long runs. During the week, I try to run a little bit, harder, again, usually with Gretchen. So the first 3 miles is a warm up, and the second 3.5 miles is usually more of a pace run. And then when I run off the bike, I try to do that a little bit faster. On our long bike rides, we do those on Sunday morning. And so that's, again, hydration. I hydrate with water and the scratch concentrate. We also take a Clif beet banana product. It looks like the baby food or the kids' food that they get in the little packages, the bunny rabbit. But this is made by Clif, and it's beet and banana. And so use that for one. Use a Bonk bar after so many miles as well. And then some EFS electrolyte. It's EFS, kind of a gel type solution that for carbohydrates. Swimming, I do that twice a week at this point, and it's up to about 42 to 4,500 yards. Again, as I said before, swimming is my weakest sport of all. It also requires the most technique, most of which I'm still learning. With the Olympics, I tried to really watch Katie Ledecky. Her technique is so wonderful, and she moves through the water so fast. And, this elusive catch, if you're a swimmer and you're listening to this, holding on to the water, and the coach, at the Masters says, feel the water, hold on to the water. And it's kind of something that's, it's like holding on to the air for me for the most part. But, some days are better than others. I used to be a golfer, and, I had a good golf swing, and then I knew the technique and where things should be in the golf swing, and I'm still finding my way with the swim stroke. But it's an awful lot like that when you're trying to swim, and you're some days that your stroke feels better than others. And, I try to swim with in the faster lanes, even though I'm not very fast, because I think that if you swim with people that are better than you, it kind of drives you. At the same time, it kind of scares me because I'm just trying to keep up, especially when we get into the more sprint phases of the practice. My times have gotten better as a result of swimming with people because I'm forced to push myself probably more than I would by myself, and certainly focus more on time than I would have by myself. So I think, as far as the Ironman 2.4 mile swim, I think I'll come out feeling okay. Hopefully I'll swim a little faster than I have in past Ironman. I don't know. Every swim's a little bit different. My first Ironman was an ocean swim, and the water was a little bit rough. The second Ironman was with current, and so it was really fast. And the third Ironman was kind of in between. So this is a river swim in Louisville, so we'll see how that is. I think some of it is probably with current, and some of it is probably against the current. So we'll see how that goes. It is a rolling start, so I like that better. There's not as much combat in the water. The ocean swim in Florida was kind of like getting in the washing machine with 1,000 friends and trying to swim around. So I like the sequential start a little bit better. It gives you a little bit more room. When I start doing endurance sports, I just did marathons. And that was certainly a challenge in and of itself. as far as pacing yourself for 26 miles and dealing with hydration and dealing with pace. The Ironman, you know, adds the swim and the bike to that and makes that whole pacing and nutrition thing even a little bit more difficult. I think it's one of the reasons why I like it, because it's, you know, it's perfection is something that is probably not, you know, obviously even a good day is hard to achieve. But certainly there's the acceptance of dealing with things that go wrong and working through them and trying to stay in the moment. And at this stage in the training for the Ironman, I start to, you know, think a little bit about trying to keep myself, you know, when I'm in the swim, stay in the swim, and when I'm in the bike, stay in the bike, and when I'm in the run, stay in the run. Don't think about the whole distance. So, you know, I'm trying to kind of get my head around all this, you know, before we, you know, get started that day. So, you know, I'm trying to do, I guess it's a little visualization on how things can go, and if things do go awry, how to fix them. You know, certainly in the bike rides in training, you have days where your legs just don't feel very good, and sometimes you just kind of accept it's going to be a day when your legs kind of hurt a little bit, and try to, you know, get in a position or get some nutrition to make things better, and you can always get through it. And I think that's where endurance athletes or endurance sports kind of mirrors life in a little bit, is that, you know, a lot of things are thrown at you, or you may have a schedule that's really bad in the morning and you're not sure how you're going to accomplish it. But, you know, little by little, as you take it one step at a time, you get through it and you're capable of accomplishing a lot more things than you really thought you could. And it's just a matter of sticking with it and, you know, maybe not focusing so much on how bad it hurts, but just your technique or just what you need to do to get by. You know, certainly my training is limited by my day job. I usually train in the mornings before I go to work. And then on the weekends, I also train in the morning before I go to work, because I go to work and usually go to the hospital after I train on Saturday and Sunday. So it is somewhat limited. I think it's to my advantage that I don't really finish a long run or ride and come home and sit down or take a nap. I usually go to work. So I think it's a little bit like a triathlon every time I do that I, you know, I keep moving. And so I'm used to keeping moving, whether it's going to the hospital or going outside to the garden. So, you know, I'm hoping that counts for something. This week I had a patient in the office, and I had given him the reference, obviously, on plant-based nutrition and forks over knife, but I also gave him the reference on Live Younger Next Year by Chris Crowley. And he's written several books now, Live Younger Next Year for Women, and the physical training component of that. And I had him on the podcast several episodes ago. And he said, well, I read that book by Chris Crowley, and I am trying to do a little bit more exercise, but I kind of think he's an idiot. And I say, what do you mean? And he's like, well, he signed up for, and if you've read the book, and I encourage you to read the book, because it's really a good read. It's humorous as well. He signs up for a spinning class that's above his level, and he really struggles to get through the spinning class. And he, you know, he makes light of it, that, you know, here he is, this older guy, and this, you know, trying to keep up with everybody. I wouldn't call him an idiot at all. You know, I'd call him, you know, somebody that's really willing to accept a challenge. And, you know, I've heard the guys from Marathon Talk speak about, you know, if you can accomplish every challenge that you set for yourself, is it really that much of a challenge? So I think it's good to have a carrot that's a little bit further out in front of you, that there may be a significant risk that you won't be able to achieve it or finish it, but you do it anyway. I'd like to send out kudos to Josh Lajani, who I've already interviewed, who set out, you know, he's lost well over 200 pounds, and he just accomplished his first 100-mile race this past weekend. And certainly it wasn't a cakewalk by any stretch of the imagination. He had some lows, but he had the support of his family there. And, you know, he put it out on Facebook and he had his friends post updates. So, you know, he put himself out there and he took a challenge and he was able to accomplish it. And he actually got third overall, which was fantastic. But, you know, the goal was just to get under 23 hours, I think. And, you know, he was 22 and a half, I believe. So, you know, again, I think sometimes we sometimes want to make it too easier on ourselves or think that things need to be easy when a challenge is something that we really need. It keeps us alive and keeps us ticking and keeps us looking forward to, you know, trying something different and troubleshooting. And I think it's good for your mind all around. You know, I would encourage people to sign up for a 5K, a 10K, a triathlon, some sort of event that they put on the calendar and they have to show up for and that they're accountable, you know, that they need to be accountable for. You know, it could be a tough mutter. It could be just it could be just meeting your friends to go for a run, you know, or to go for a walk and commit to doing it. Recently, there's another challenge going around Facebook, the 22 push-up challenge, and it's to raise awareness for troops with post-traumatic stress disorder and the risk of suicide. But it's also a challenge to, you know, one, it makes you think about the troops, and, you know, their service to our country. But it gives people a challenge to try to do something and put themselves out of their comfort zone a little bit. So I think things like that are a good idea. So anyway, on to back to nutrition and, I guess what I'm eating, lately, new favorite lunch. You know, I post a lot of my stuff that I eat on Instagram, but I kind of stumbled upon, you know, leftovers that I put together that I really like, which is a bowl of steamed spinach with a baked potato and salsa. That's been become one of my favorite go-to lunches if I haven't leftover baked potato. And, you know, again, so just remember, always bake more potatoes than you're going to use. So yeah, you have that to throw in your lunch the next day. I suggested today to a patient that's having trouble staying on the plant-based wagon or the healthy wagon to actually have a mid-morning snack of greens and a little round boiled potatoes, because that's certainly better than grabbing a piece of bread and cream cheese or grabbing something else that's doesn't have near as much nutrients, you know. So the little potatoes are full of nutrients, fiber, B vitamins, vitamin C, potassium, magnesium, and of course the spinach is going to give you your greens. So if you steam a couple handfuls of spinach, you can steam probably 2 cups of spinach really easy and eat that about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. It would tie you over to lunch. Certainly going to keep you out of the snack food drawer. The other thing I still like is the sushi salad, where I just take what you would get in vegetable sushi and put it in a big bowl and eat it along with greens, which is usually spinach or romaine lettuce, and then I throw a pepper in there and some tomatoes and maybe there's always a cucumber and carrot and some avocado. And then I use a little tamari with wasabi and ginger to give it the sushi type seasonings, along with the chopped up nori wrapper on top. Beans and greens are still a go-to lunch for me. So a can of black beans or cooked black beans over salad with all the different fixings, and salsa again. During the week, pretty much, I eat fruit and nuts until lunchtime. So I'll hydrate after my run with a fruit smoothie. I always send my neighbor, my mother, over a glass. And then I drink the rest, and then I bring a jar of fruit with some walnuts and pumpkin seeds to work. And that varies, but I pack that little jar tight, and I eat that. And that really holds me. I don't get hungry till lunchtime. It holds me much better than other things. And so I would encourage you to try to get off of the cereal wagon, you know, the Cheerios. Somebody talked to me about cornflakes today, and it's like I just told my head, it's, you know, there's just no real nutrient value of cornflakes. I think about, you know, feeding pigs' corn, you know, it's just, it's such a waste. You might as well, you know, the box is probably as has as many nutrients as, you know, the cornflakes. So try to get away from the cereal aisle. It's such a marketing ploy. You know, I was standing in the checkout line this week, and I looked up and I saw Count Chocula cereal, you know, when I was a kid. At Halloween time, that's when it kind of first came out, Count Chocula, and I think it's Boo Berry, and I think there might be another one now, but I always like Count Chocula. And they're just sugary cereals, but, you know, they're right there on the end counter as, you know, you're going to come off the aisle, so kids are going to see them. And, you know, somehow we've been led to believe over the years, that thanks to Kellogg's, that cereal is, you know, the best and is such a nutritious breakfast, and it really, really isn't. So, you know, I encourage all my patients to either do oatmeal and do the refrigerator oatmeal. That's what I do on the weekends. I put the oatmeal in the refrigerator with the cinnamon and raisins, and then add to it the next morning, and it's cooked. You know, obviously I put some almond milk on it. But again, during the week, I really, really do like the fruit. So, you know, try it. Cut up some fruit and put it in a Tupperware and take it with you to work or eat it before you go. It's a really good breakfast, and you're getting a lot of good nutrients, and it's very hydrating. You know, we still have watermelons available down here. Actually, they're coming from, I think, up north, but, you know, we still eat those, and they're very, very hydrating. And again, a lot of vitamin C to it, and there's a good bit of fiber in those things. So it's really good. You know, I used to hate the end of summer up in West Virginia because then you couldn't get watermelon anymore. But that's one of the good things about Florida is you can get some watermelon. It's not so good in the winter, but it's pretty good for another month or so. And then my dinners, we've been trying to use okra in as many ways as we can since the okra is growing in the garden. We have soup once a week, usually, whether it's bean soup or potato soup or some sort of carrot soup, vegetable soup. But that's usually at least once a week. We probably have some sort of a casserole dish once a week. I've got into the shaved fennel salad that I think I talked about last week with shaved fennel, orange, and spinach and red cabbage with kind of a ginger dressing that's really, really good. Also, since Florida avocados are in season right now, they're a little bit more watery. They're the big green ones if you haven't had a Florida avocado. They're a little bit more watery and even less taste than a Haas avocado. But I found that they're really good to cook with as far as making mousse. So I made some chocolate mousse last weekend with the Florida avocado. So just a little agave and cacao powder and the Florida avocado. And then sprinkled some crushed up nuts on that. It was a really good dessert. Class this week, I made potato leek soup in the Instapot, so that worked out good. I use a base of carrots and celery and some leeks and then the potatoes. And so about 25 minutes, you have that in the Instapot, and I use a immersion blender to kind of blend that up and then top it with some more leeks. And so everybody liked that. And then I did a kale salad with avocado, dried cranberries, sunflowers with just lemon juice. And everybody's really surprised that, oh, there's just lemon juice on that. And I showed them how to massage the kale with the avocado. And that'll make the kale, you know, if you're having trouble eating your kale, if you massage the avocado with avocado, half avocado in your big bowl of kale, or even massage it with homemade hummus, it'll make it a lot more tender, and try to eat it that way. But the lemon juice really goes good with it. We talked about kids. There's a couple that have some young children and struggling a little bit on getting them on the plant-based wagon. You know, I think anybody that has children, we talked a little bit about it last week. This is the prime time of their life to develop their gut microbes and to make them healthy. And, you know, in some respects, it's sad to see kids, you know, we always want better, more for our kids than we had for ourselves. And I think that nutrition is one way as well. So if you're learning about plant-based nutrition, you know that it's a very healthy way to eat. So to have your children not eat that way, I think, is a disservice. They'll come around. So, you know, one things that you can do, you know, again, is educate them on the environmental aspects and the animal aspects. You know, they need to know where their food comes from. And, you know, they'll come around. You know, again, that they don't really need to get a vote on what you're served. You know, it's your job as a parent to serve them nutritious food. And, you know, I think it's really important. I listened to a podcast this week about a woman that struggled with weight all of her life, and topped out at over 400 pounds. And, you know, she spoke about as a child being heavy and as a child hiding and eating and being put on a diet at 11 years of age. And you know, I don't think that we should berate children, you know, as far as, you know, making them separate from their other siblings. But again, you can see where the being overweight as a child is very detrimental. And the peer pressure and the bullying just gets worse as kids get older. So you're not doing them any favors by letting things get out of hand. And I think kids that are prone to be overweight as young children, especially if one sibling is thin and the other's heavy, there's probably some underlying issues there that need to be addressed. But there's always the question of this gut microflora. And, you know, I think there's probably something to that you need to, again, be really cognizant to feed the children healthy, to develop good gut flora, and, you know, perhaps that they would benefit from some probiotics if that's going on. But I would really, look into that with a child psychologist early on, as well as a pediatrician. But, you know, I think a whole food plant-based diet really helps out because, again, you're going to select for better gut flora. You're going to give them fiber. You can develop their taste buds for fruit. And, you know, if they're prone to overeating, at least if they're eating a low-calorie dense amount of food, it's going to be much less detrimental to them. And if they've got a cause associated with it, a cause is where the animals came from, animal cruelty, environment, then, you know, they have a team to get on, and it's not a punishment, but it's a team for them to be on, to try to be healthy and to promote health and to help other people. There's a little video circulating around, Facebook that with a little girl upset because she doesn't want to eat animals. And you know, I think most kids, you know, if they really knew where their food comes from, especially at a young age, they're going to want to be on the plant-based, team. Things that you can also do to help their taste buds is, you know, introduce some of the smoothies, let them make it and concoct it themselves. The cheesy sauce with cashews and macadamia nuts and nutritional yeast is really good for cauliflower and broccoli to try to get them over the hump of eating that. And again, you're giving them nutrients when they eat it that way as opposed to cheese. You can do the butternut squash cheese as well. Again, so that's even more nutrients that they have the butternut squash as well as the other vegetables. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that you can come up with. Soups, you know, are usually palatable to everybody because there's a bunch of things in the soup. Potato soups are really easy soup. Chilies are really easy. And try to steer the kids away from the flour products at an early age. You know, we start to throw what's easy at kids, and I think that's where their taste buds get ruined. So I'm not so sure that we don't help to really get their microbes screwed up at an early age by, you know, it's giving them these fast foods and box foods, the high salt, high sugar foods. So, you know, be aware of it and kind of take charge. And, you know, it might be tough for a couple of weeks, but after that, I think that it'll certainly get be much easier. The other thing is the apple slices and the dehydrator, you know, to make some things like that are really good for snacks. And even dried fruit with the kids, you know, that's a good reasonable snack to put on, you know, their oatmeal and things. And speaking about the microbiome, I have been reading The Human Superorganism by Rodney Dieterich, D-I-E-T-E-R-T. It's been very, very interesting, you know, looking at the microbiome and, you know, again, from infancy, the development and what we can do to correct our microbiome. There's a company called Ubiome, and it's U-B-I-O-M-E, that you can actually get your microbiome sequenced and find out, you know, the diversity of your microbiome. The way he talks about it is, you know, different regions of the world, people have a different prevalence of certain bacteria. Certainly there are, you know, good bacteria and bad bacteria, but your kind of DNA sequence is kind of regional. And so it's better to make your region, you know, try to stick within your own region. It's kind of like growing crops. You know, you can grow certain crops in Florida and certain crops in California. And to try to grow a California crop in Florida is not that easy. So when you're trying to, you know, do some correction of your microbiome, it's probably going to come eventually, you know, to be very specific therapies as to, you know, regions and ethnic backgrounds and things. So there's a whole, you know, whole new phase of medicine, you know, coming about. But their website, the Ubiome, is actually really very good. You know, there's you know, children that are raised with dogs and you know, seem to do better than kids that didn't. And if you look at the dogs and cats have a different microflora than humans. But if you and your partner have a dog, then you share more of your partner's bacteria, just because you pet the dog and your bacteria is on the dog skin and they pet the dog, and so you kind of share your microbiome, and it, you know, the diversity is, it kind of works out good for everybody. And the kids that have a dog at early age, you know, a decreased risk of allergy and asthma. So, you know, I remember when my daughter was, when I first brought her home, we had a dog. And, you know, my mom, it's, you know, it's kind of back in the day when, you know, when I was little, dogs were kind of, you know, they weren't part of the family, so to speak. They got to the basement for the most part. But, you know, when we got a dog, he was everywhere. And, you know, my mother was kind of appalled that, you know, that dog would be everywhere and there's a new baby in the house and that she, you know, she was going to die of some terrible infection from the dog. And the reality of it is, you know, you do better from the dog, and you get a lot of good bacteria from being around the dog. And there's, you know, this calming effect. People do better, seem to be calmer if they have a dog. And it could be because of the microbiome and different neurotransmitters are stimulated from the sharing of the microbiome. So there's all kinds of interesting things coming out. Certainly, you know, I encourage you to eat probiotics and prebiotics, not so much probiotics at first, but prebiotics in the form of fermented food. There's a recipe for sauerkraut, which is just basically cabbage with 1.5 tablespoons of salt, which is a lot of salt. I don't know if you can get away with that. If doing less, have to kind of look into that. Some people do vinegar. But then it'd have to be kind of, I guess, watered out at some point. But, you know, pickles, if you don't have heart failure or terrible high blood pressure, pickles and other fermented foods are certainly good prebiotics. There's, you know, several good books about fermentation out there, so you can kind of look into that. But that's always, you know, a good way to help get your microbiome kind of on tune and go in the right direction. And certainly if you've, you know, have had a course of antibiotics, or you've, you know, you think you've had some GI issues, I do think a trial of probiotics is a good way to start. And I would consider doing the evaluation of your microbiome. I think that's going to be more prevalent with primary, you know, with when you see your primary care, as far as your gut health is going to be, hopefully start to be much more important, just like asking about other things and, you know, immunizations and whatever. that you should, you know, your gut health is going to be much more important. So I guess in the last little bit of tonight, I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about the, again, being plant-based in a world of people that aren't plant-based and how you get along. I had a couple patients, interactions with patients this week, one traveling to Italy with a group that their food was arranged, and so they didn't eat plant-based the whole time that they were gone, and pretty much fell off the plant-based wagon, and diabetes got a lot worse. And you know, what do you do about that? Most of the time, you don't have to get in that situation. If you really want to declare yourself plant-based, there's probably nowhere in the world you can't go and make it happen. Especially with tour companies, you can request plant-based meals. Certainly, flights plant-based meal. It might not be the best, and you might be exposed to some oil or more salt than you're used to. But you know, it's certainly doable. I think you can also communicate when you get to a restaurant and look for places. If you had a shellfish allergy, you wouldn't eat shellfish when you went to the restaurant. Just because it was there, you say, I can't eat that. So I think you have to look at it that way. So you really, you know, you're really allergic if you have health problems to, you know, animal products and butter and oil. So, I think it's perfectly fine to express that, and you shouldn't be made to feel bad that you do express that the need for a plant-based meal. It's kind of back to that point when you declare declare that you're going to take control of your health, then I think that you need to accept that you're going to do that when you go on vacation, because you can throw yourself off so bad. You know, you've worked so hard to get your taste buds to change. You start to get your microbiome to change. You get off of medications. You're weaning down. Your blood pressure's under control. Your endothelium's starting to heal. And then you go on a week's vacation where everything goes to pot again. And so you're really back down. It's kind of like getting a running injury and being sidelined for 6 weeks, and you have to start all over. You can certainly start all over, and I would encourage you to do it. But if, you know, you get the best success if you can have continued growth of that behavior. So, you know, think about it when you're getting ready to go on vacation and plan ahead. There's lots of online apps to pick restaurants along the way. There's you know, airlines will you know, offer plant-based. If you're going to a conference, they offer vegan meals. When you're going to a hotel, call ahead of time. If you're booking with a travel agency, you know, tell them that you're interested in being plant-based or vegan. You know, there are vegan cruises. There's one in March, the Holistic Cruise. There's several tour groups now that are vegan tour groups that tour Europe. So consider doing one of those in your travels. Again, you know, we visited the Stanford Inn in Mendocino, California. You know, that's an all vegan inn. So, you know, there are places like that to go. But again, most places are accommodating these days, and most certainly major cities have vegan options all over the place. So it's just a matter of, you know, declaring it. If you're traveling with people that aren't plant-based, then, you know, I think you have to have the frank conversation with them. You know, I always say you learn a lot about people when you travel with them. And if they're not willing to compromise, then perhaps those aren't the people that you really should be traveling with. And sometimes you do, you know, sometimes you're really, you know, you want to be with them enough that you're willing to put up with it. But I think that, you know, you have the frank conversation that I need to be able to eat, you know, what I need to be able to eat, and I'll compromise. And it, you know, maybe it's not 100% of you know, what I would like as far as being low oil, or maybe the amount of greens that you would necessarily like to have, but at least you're still plant-based, and you're not exposed to animal products if you don't want to be. I had another patient who actually has called a couple restaurants now in advance and got plant-based options when he visited. And, you know, he's starting to feel really good about himself because he's able to go out and get food and still be plant-based. And he's becoming more confident in his decision to be plant-based and to get good food to eat when he goes out and has a good time. I think that people that aren't plant-based are worried that their good time is going to be ruined when they go out if they're not able to get their traditional comfort foods. And so it's more of an insecurity on their part. And then it leads to challenging questions that maybe you're not quite comfortable in answering just yet. I try to prepare people in my class for, you know, the where do you get your protein questions, where do you get your calcium questions, you know, the good comeback is where do you get your fiber. But, you know, I think it's best to not to try not to be controversial. And, you know, I think the best advertisement for being plant-based is to ask a restaurant to prepare you some plant-based, you know, food. Or, again, look at the menu and kind of make a menu for yourself. Pick and choose on the menu. Could you please make me this? And when your dish comes out and it looks really nice and people see that, because most people like vegetables, they just don't know what to order and they're afraid they won't get full or they're afraid they won't enjoy it. So when they see a nice plant-based dinner come out, then, you know, it's like, well, hey, that actually looks pretty good. And they may be ultimately willing to try at some point, or at least not make such a big deal out of it. But then, you know, the bottom line is just do what you think is right and don't worry about, you know, again, like your parents used to say, don't worry about what other people think. Answer questions that are asked of you, but, you know, you don't necessarily have to bring it up. And you certainly don't have to defend yourself because, you know, you're not making them defend themselves or why they're eating meat and animal products. I think it's great that people go out to dinner because if you go out and you ask the chef to make you a plant-based meal, then that opens their eyes up and it spreads the word in a very positive way. And, you know, chefs, for the most part, like to be creative if you're in a, you know, especially a private restaurant. And when they make something and they make you happy, it makes them happy because obviously they like to see people eat and enjoy it. And it makes them think outside the box a little bit. And, you know, and it spreads the word in a very positive manner as opposed to just avoiding, you know, a restaurant, altogether. Now, you know, when you go to a chain restaurant that, you know, everything's the same, whether it's Texas or Pennsylvania or Florida, you're not going to have much leeway and they're not going to prepare you anything special because they're not hiring people that are capable of doing that. So, you know, then that's when you pick the baked potato and the salad off the menu and you just call it a day. And there is nothing wrong with, you know, declaring your ethics about not eating meat if that is your belief. I don't ever try to push that on anybody else or ask them about their beliefs, but I'm not bashful about, you know, declaring that I don't think that it's necessary to have to eat animals. I also believe that helps a lot of people stay on the plant-based wagon when there's more than one reason for being plant-based. It's a very interesting time. You know, the microbiome is tying into neurotransmitters and how we feel, you know, not eating animals and eating and being more positive, you know, whether that's because your microbiome has changed or because, you know, of a general energy in the world, I don't know. But, you know, I see much more positivity in the plant-based community than in general. And, you know, that can't be a bad thing, no matter how you, you know, what reason you give for it being. And I think even researchers, the author of the book that I was reading started out in looking at, you know, ways to make chickens healthier, you know, that were factory farmed. And I could kind of tell as the book progressed that, you know, he was starting to think about things in a different light. At least I hope he did, because part of that was a little bit hard to swallow as far as how he referred to the chickens. But I think the more information that you read and the more knowledge that you get, you know, it makes you more aware all in all, and you're more likely to be plant-based. And, you know, it's when everything comes together in the next few years, I think we'll start to, you know, deal more with, you know, what makes us start to eat more, and food will be focused more on what makes us healthy as opposed to what comforts us. And I think as healthcare providers, it is our duty to educate people on the benefits of a whole food plant-based diet, but not only to, you know, that it exists and what it is, but how to go about changing and how to about obtaining food in a reasonable fashion, you know, whether it be, you know, directing people to farmers market cooking classes, or having backyard gardens. You know, I think that that's part of the whole treatment approach for the future patient and healthcare and prevention, and more importantly, and in health. So take home messages from today's rambling is, if your gut's not happy, consider taking some probiotics and perhaps getting your gut bacteria tested. Try some fermented vegetables that are lower in salt, and perhaps rinse them before you eat them. Declare yourself plant-based and stick to it, even in situations that might make you a little bit uncomfortable, because once you do it once, it'll be easier the next time. Set some challenges for yourself that are a little bit out of your comfort zone. It'll make you feel better again in the long run, and maybe even take a long run. You're never too old to become healthier. You're never too old to become more flexible. You're never too old to become more tolerant. So have a good week.